little. We drove. I'm still a little tired, but actually doing okay. So please remember that on Wednesday, it'll be my wife teaching you, going through Cicero, I think, depending on how far we get today. And then, of course, you'll have the midterm on Friday, and she'll be here proctoring that. I think I had told you that I will be gone Wednesday through Sunday, and then I don't travel again until November. So if you do need me, the best way to get a hold of me is through email. And I will have office hours tomorrow, just about 11 to right before 1, not quite to 1, but right before. So if you do want to see me, please try and see me tomorrow afternoon, because that's going to be the only time. Sorry about that, but that'll be the only time this week I'll have office hours. So if you do have questions or something, let me know, and hopefully I can get back to you pretty quickly. So what I'd like to do today, we're making another big transition, as of course this class in many ways is nothing but transitions, as we're going into another period of Western civilization. And we've gone past the Hellenistic period now, and yet there's a lot of overlap. And we're going to look to what happened at Rome. If you remember how we had talked about this a few weeks ago on Sounding Rome, in the fifth week of classes, but when you think back, and if you remember, I talked quite a bit about timelines, and that even though we have people like Abraham way before most of his class, that when we get to Plato, and when we get to Socrates, and then Aristotle, we already have Rome. Rome is our existence. So we always, in history, we go from the Jews to the Greeks to the Romans, but that's kind of a conceit. And it makes sense in terms of how civilization flows in the West, but it would be a mistake to think that they're somehow separated. The Mediterranean was, for all intents and purposes, a very small world that was all interconnected. So it would be really impossible to have one thing happen in the Mediterranean that was not known elsewhere. So much of what we see in the development of Rome is being reflected in Greek philosophic thought. Though the Romans are still rustics, that is, they're considered very backwards in the way that maybe people from Ann Arbor think of us. So it would be a kind of rural-urban divide. Greece was very cosmopolitan. Rome, prior to the rise of its empire, was just considered a nation of really hardworking, kind of dumb farmers. So that idea, and you'll see some of the attitudes. I mean, when you read Cato, I can hear, not that they're dumb, they're quite the opposite, but I can hear my uncles, especially my Kansas farmer uncles, talking in very much the same language. And I hear my wife's Texas in-laws, who could easily have been Roman Republicans in every way, the way they think about life, the way they think about cycles and so forth. So we'll talk about that and why that's significant for us. But what we call Rome as a city, as a republic, and then later as an empire, all begins somewhat mysteriously, and yet part of it is well known. It begins in 510 BC. So this is, if you'll remember, it's the same year that, as far as we know, it's the same year that we're seeing the first philosophical discussions in Miletus. So at the same time we're having those great discussions between Thales and Heraclitus, and those people talking about fire and water and earth and air, those same people, as they're talking, we have on the other side of the Mediterranean, we have Rome being founded. So right about the exact same time, if not exactly at the same time. It's coincidence, of course, but it's kind of happy, nice coincidence. Rome begins in 510 through a pretty serious revolt against a people that we still don't know a lot about, called the Etruscans. And what we do know about the Etruscans comes almost exclusively from the Romans writing about them. The Etruscans were probably, and we know a little bit about them because we still have some of their art and we still have some of their written language, but even the language, it's so complex that our best linguists still have not been able to decipher and make something whole out of the Etruscan language. It still remains somewhat of a mystery to us in all kinds of ways, actually. But what we do know about the Etruscans, they were a very, very decadent people. And they were very taken with their own sexuality and with their own sensuality. And we see that in the art that remains, that they tended to focus pretty much on a kind of hedonistic level of pleasure from what little we know of them. So there was their society tends to be very elite, very decadent, and they had oppressed the Romans. The Romans were their slaves for all intents and purposes. So we also know that they had a monarchy, probably a dual monarchy among the Etruscans. So the Romans, who from the beginning, this tribal people, the Latins, these people who found Rome on the Tiber, they had always been, and I want you to think about how this meshes with today, how human nature doesn't change, but they are truly our kind of farmers that you would meet in western Kansas or western Nebraska or Texas. These are, they're rustics, they are very common people. The work ethic is everything to a Roman. The idea of sexuality is purely for marriage. It is never, the idea that you would commit adultery is just a horrific sin in the ideas of the Romans. So I'm sure we all have the image of the Roman imperials who are having orgies and vomitoriums and so forth. This is totally different from the early Romans. The early Romans are really kind of like New England Puritans in the way that they live life. In fact, the New England Puritans would probably make many of the Romans look like liberal decadents in a lot of ways. So the New Englanders would look that way compared to the Romans. The Romans had a very, very strong sense of morality, and they were probably, not only did they not like being oppressed by the Etruscans, but they were offended by Etruscan culture. This was exactly the opposite. They cherished their daughters, the Romans did. They cherished the image that their daughters would carry. Their daughters would be pure until marriage, and then once marriage. This was a really significant thing for them. And I hope, you know, we didn't talk about this too much, but, and it's not politically correct at all, but it's just a fact of history. This is a theme, a major theme in Western civilization. Do we abide by the kind of sexuality and decadence of civilized peoples, or do we tend to like a kind of primitivism in terms of virtue? And that, we didn't talk about this, but it was very clear that one of the things that the Jews are revolting against the Greeks about is the issue of homosexuality. They do not like that. The Jews are deeply offended by this and the fact that it comes so easily to the Greeks and to Greek culture. The same thing is true with the Romans. You know, whatever our own views are, and that's not what we're here to talk about, but whatever our own views, the Romans, and especially the Republicans, were offended by any what they considered abnormalities, whether it was heterosexual or homosexual. This was just, you don't do this. It's in marriage. It's very much a part of our society that we take this thing as a sacred thing. So just, I'm not trying to pass judgment on it. I just want you to keep that in mind, that it's a very important aspect as we find both the revolt of the Jews against the Greeks and the Romans against the Etruscans. These are a terrible people as the Romans see it. So the Romans not only overthrow the Etruscans, but in response to the monarchy and the decadence of the Etruscans, they create the second republic the world has seen. And when they create this republic, when the Romans do, and the republic's official date is 509, so 1 year after the revolt, when the Romans create the Republic, and please stop me if this doesn't make sense, because this is not like our founding. This is very different from our founding, even though we're both republics. When the Romans create the Roman Republic, they do not believe that they know enough to create an absolute kind of form of government. They just know it's a republic. They create monarchy. And so they want a republic that avoids the idea of monarchy. But they don't know exactly. When we go into it and we write the Constitution, we have Aristotle and Plato, and we have the Romans, so we can learn. We know, okay, we want the three branches of government. There has to be balance of powers. Romans didn't have that advantage. They knew that a republic was natural, but they didn't know how that would play out. So unlike us, where we talk about our founding in 1776 and 1787, the Romans don't have that. They have the founding date of 509 of the republic, but their constitution evolves over about 200, 300 years. So unlike us, who sit down and over a summer write a constitution, these guys, the Romans, are content to allow the constitution to develop out of trial and error. So we do one thing. It works or it doesn't. And it's a lot about, we would probably consider this close to anarchy, frankly. But the Romans had so many norms, so many rules of morality, and the way that they behaved, that there was no such thing as anarchy, even if the law didn't necessarily deal with this. There were just such strong customs for these Romans. So they are making a republic, but they do so, for those of you, look at that, someone has written res publica. Did I do that?
That's not my writing, is it? No, it's not. Somebody else was in here talking about the same thing. It's great. All right, so we've got the Republic, 509. But as they do it, this is where, and where I was going to get before I got distracted by this. This is, for those of you in modern, who studied modern political thought, this would be deeply Hayekian after Friedrich Hayek. The idea that we discover what is true as opposed to creating it is a very poetic way of thinking about it. That there's a kind of a trial and error aspect about this. So when the Romans create their republic, they decide, and it's, remember, as I mentioned a moment ago, it's the second republic created in world history. The first was the Carthaginians. When the Romans create their republic, they decide that the greatest thing they can do to make this a long-lasting republic, doesn't matter what the law is, what they want is they want a republic based on virtue. And so this will be the great conflict within the Mediterranean world between Carthage and Rome. Carthage, as an earlier republic, was based on the idea of commerce. So we want self-interest in a republic. Self-interest, they thought, was the way to allow for a society to flourish. The Romans said exactly the opposite. In a republic with the res publica, we have to have virtue, not commerce, as the center of all things. There's nothing wrong with commerce, but it's a lower thing. So the higher thing to do in society, what you do with your freedom, is you voluntarily serve your community. It's okay to make money, but you have to recognize when you make money, that's a secondary good. That's not the highest good. It's a second good. So that it's fine, but of course you're out for yourself when you're making money. It's not the same thing as being virtuous and giving yourself to the republic. Does that make sense for everyone? Because this will be, even when we get into American history, this will be a huge conflict among the founders as well. Do we want a commercial republic or do we want a virtuous republic? And this tension, it's deeply rooted in history, but it's clear that our founders were also, they had read Carthage and they had read Rome, and they're trying to figure out what they want to be. And in the debates, especially during the founding, the American founders will talk about, we don't want to be Carthage. And what they mean is we don't want to become Britain. That's their code for Britain and the way they say that. So that's a commercial empire republic as opposed to a virtuous republic. Our language, especially if you're libertarian, our language of free markets and that kind of idea that we want a commercial society doesn't really develop until after the War of 1812. It's not in the founding. It's in about 50 years after the founding. We start seeing that as a good, as if pursuing self-interest is a good, but you don't see that in the founding. So, and that all goes back to Rome. So everybody kind of clear on that and what that means? Okay, so if that's true and you guys are all okay with it, what do we know about the Romans? Well, they're farmers, almost exclusively. And they believe very strongly in the idea that you would live with the soil. This is part of being a member of the created order. You get up with the sun, you go to bed with the sun. And farming was essential to their way of life. You distrust cities, you distrust commerce, you especially distrust bankers, because they're not making anything, they're just pretending to move finance around. And they were worried about all of this. So the three great virtues, and you guys do have to know this, so you already know, you had to know prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude. The Romans offer three additional virtues to this, and I do want you to know them. They're not as important as the four. So the four virtues you've already had, those will go all the way to the present day. The three virtues are going to be replaced by St. Paul's faith, hope, and charity, which are not the Roman virtues. So I do want you to know them, but I want you to realize that even though the Romans considered them equal to the first four, they had never caught on in society in the same way that the first four did, and the way Paul's faith, hope, and charity will. So they had three virtues, and their virtues are piety, faith, and labor. And of course, these are all in the, I'm anglicizing them, obviously. So, exactly, very nice. So these are the three virtues that they have, and this is how it breaks down. Piety is exactly what it seems like, but it is not quite the Christian virtue of piety. So if you imagine, if you want to think of the ultimate Christian understanding of piety, you can think of the great statue of Mary holding Jesus as he's dying or is dead.
And she's holding him, and of course the pietas. And the idea behind that is that true virtue, true piety, is looking towards your Creator. So here's both mother as well as worshiper of her son. And that's a very modern, very Christian understanding of piety. Not quite modern, but Christian. For the Romans, piety meant that you honored your ancestors as the voice of God, or the gods. So it's a bit of an inverse. If we wanted to do a Roman version of piety, it would be more Jesus looking to his mother than his mother looking to the son. So the Roman version was that not all of our ancestors, of course, but our ancestors as a whole were the voice of God. And we never take what we've inherited from them lightly. So over time, it doesn't mean every generation was right, but over time, our ancestors, through trial and error, have discovered what is necessary to lead the good life. So remember, and I'll probably have this, you know, on your final, it won't be on your midterm because the way you have the terms, but imagine, you know, as Pericles said, very importantly, we love our fathers because they love their fathers. That's very Greek. It's also extremely Roman. So the idea that, of course, we would love our mother and father, this is piety, because they love their mothers and fathers. And so piety is this intense desire to carry on to the next generation what you had inherited from the previous generation. So this will play out both religiously as well as philosophically and intellectually for the Romans. They always want to think about what is necessary. So the one body, the one governmental body they do create, probably as early as 509, is the Senate. And the Senate comes from the Latin term for the wise old men. And that was a way of honoring. A senator was not necessarily elite. It was someone who had proven themselves through the virtue of their family and through their own actions. So the Senate does become a somewhat aristocratic body, but that wasn't its original intention. It was meant to just be a sense of honoring the wise, those who have given themselves in some way. So obviously we still carry that on. The very fact we use the term Senate for upper body is extremely Roman. And this is a very Roman world in all kinds of ways. America is extremely Roman, but we can get more into that. So piety was this belief that you carry this on. And this is, you don't see this depiction that often. I mean, you'll find this in a lot of cultures. So especially in modern culture, you might find this in some old forms of Eastern Orthodoxy and Roman Catholicism. And you'd also find it in Shintoism in Japan, but the kind of real honoring of the ancestors, where you might actually have, you know, you might have a shrine to an ancestor, or you might put something up where you light a candle. And it's not just to a saint, but to someone within your family. And it's not as blatant in the West anymore. It's much more in Asian culture, at least within certain nationalistic Asian cultures. But that idea that you might put an image of, you know, we would do this, but Romans might have put an image of the grandfather, and then they put a candle or incense next to it, and they would light it. And the idea was that your ancestors are speaking for you in the heavens. They're your defenders in the heavens. In the way that, say, a Catholic or an Orthodox might think saints do that, this is the way they thought about their ancestors. So there was always this piety that was absolutely critical to them. But the second virtue, that of fate, is a very Stoic virtue, and what we read last week from Epictetus and the Stoics, this is just in Roman society. They don't need philosophers to talk about this. They already believe it. Stoicism is inherent. It is natural to the Roman way of mind, so at least the Roman Republic. So the Republicans and the idea of fate is simply that you accept your lot in life. So when you're born, you accept that as a gift. When you begin to decay, you accept that as a gift. When your mother or father dies or you lose a child, it's all a gift. You have to accept this because it is the fate of the gods. It is the fate of the divine that this is your life. So fate is one of the three greats. You have to be able to accept this. You have to understand that whatever happens, even when it seems evil, is probably a corrective for what you've done or what you should be doing that you're not doing. So all things ultimately work toward the good in terms of the way our life plays out. So if I get cancer, I don't curse God. I praise God, and then I show that I can die with dignity. That's a very stoic attitude based on the Roman idea of fate. It also means that if you're born with certain gifts, you are fated to use them and to go with them. If you're born with an infirmity, you are also fated to that. So there's not a lot of grace in this. That's the hard thing, I think, for us coming in a post-Christian era. There's not a lot of grace. It is a very willful universe that we accept. And when we don't accept it, it just creates more problems. So it's better to accept the fate than to fight against it. And yet we always kind of like those guys who fight against it and who win. So Aeneas, in many ways, I don't know if we're going to get to talk about Virgil much or the Aeneid, but the great story of Rome is the Aeneid by Virgil. And much of it plays into the idea, is Aeneas as a hero, is he working against fate, or is fate working with him, whether he knows it or not? It's one of the great Roman questions. And it's not, I'm not sure Christians still have, we could bring a Calvinist and a Thomist in this room, they would still be arguing pretty fiercely over fate versus free will. It's not that different than the kinds of things the Romans were wrestling with and trying to figure this out. So that you can find that still, I think, it plays out in Western Civ and these great questions of fatalism and stoicism and of free will. The final virtue for the Romans was truly what it sounds like. You work hard. That's a virtue. You work unbelievably hard. The Romans have no use for anybody who will not work to the best of their ability. You are nothing in society if you do not work. Now, if there's something physically wrong with you and you're not capable of working, the Romans will do what they can to bring that person into society in some way, or they'll get rid of that person. But they do have a very brutal attitude about this. This is the Puritan work ethic on steroids. So this is why it was a good with Cato, and I hope you guys saw this, that when you read Cato, he may have slaves, but he works as hard as his slaves when he's in the field. And he makes sure that they work hard. And if you'll remember, and this is, again, not politically correct at all in our day and age, but remember when Cato discovers someone who doesn't work hard, what's his claim about them? Did you catch this? Whether they're in battle or in the field laboring? What's he say about them? They're not men. They're animals. They don't deserve to live. So if you don't work hard, if you don't do your best, you really don't qualify as being a human. And that was very rooted in the Roman Republic. And it is, I think, to our modern ears, it sounds terrible, but it wasn't that way for most of society. And I don't think George Washington would have found it that terrible. I think he would have sympathized in many ways. But in our modern era, over the last 100 years, we've become much more like the Roman Imperials than we have the Roman Republicans. And that's something we'll have to keep talking about. But I do want you to think about that. So these three virtues, and you can see how they go together. The fact that you love your ancestors because they worked hard and gave us what we have now. We love fate because it's what we've been given, and we deal with it. There's no sense in whining about it. You accept it and do the best with it you can, and we work hard. And they all kind of fit together. You can get a kind of whole picture of what it meant to be an ideal Roman Republican by doing this. You can also see, I think equally importantly, why they would have hated the Etruscans, a people who lived off the labor of others, a people who were soft and decadent and sexual and did things that the Romans found disgusting. Yeah, this is, of course you do that. If you have idle hands, you're going to start thinking about things you shouldn't be thinking about from the Roman perspective. So they had a very strong work ethic about this. They felt the same about the Greeks. Yeah, the Greeks were suspect. They should be admired for what they accomplished. They should be admired for defeating the Persians, at least during the Persian Wars. They should be admired for Alexander's gumption. But you hate them as well because they were soft. And that was the term. And this is, I always find this kind of funny. Again, not at all what would go over very well in modern culture. But the term for the Greeks, even the best of the Greeks, was, and this is how the Romans referred to them, they were always Greeklings, which is, they're weaklings. They're not real. They're kind of soft, and they spend too much time writing plays and poetry. Real men work, and real women have babies and keep the house nice, and that was their view. So who has time to write poetry? who has time to think about philosophy? And that's why we won't see really the great Roman scholars and philosophers and poets until the end of the Republic. We'll see there's a huge, and we call this, I don't know if we'll get to this today, probably talk about it a lot more, my wife will, on Wednesday, but there's what's called the Augustan Age of literature. And that Augustan Age is just this huge explosion of literary works at the end of the Republic. And most of them are pro-Republican writers, people like Virgil, people like Cicero, but they really can only kind of come after that idea of, well, we're not just warriors, we're not just senators, we're not just farmers, but we actually can take some good things from the Greeks, like rhetoric. We can take things such as philosophy and poetry. So a lot of that will play into this. Bless you, Luke. So that's going to come in a variety of different ways. Okay, so any questions on this? All right, so let's look, if you guys don't mind. Actually, even if you do mind, we're going to do it, but that was my courtesy, trying to bring everybody into this. Let's look at Polybius and talk about what it is that Polybius sees here. So Polybius, if you had a chance to read, did you guys want to, Alexander, do you mind moving over so our guests can look at your book? Would that be okay? Thank you. So, thank you. All right, so let's look to 181. And you get this very quickly in the intro. But Polybius is a Greek slave. Right, so he's a Greek prisoner of war. He's been captured by the Romans. And a lot of what Polybius is trying to write about here as a non-Roman is an expression of admiration for what the Romans do right. So this is a guy who is trained liberally. He knows his Socrates, his Plato, and his Aristotle extremely well. And he's now applying it to what he sees in Rome. So, somebody want to read? Start here. Charles, please. Thank you. So just start, I am aware.
All right. I am aware that some will be at a loss to account for my interrupting the course of my narrative for the sake of entering upon the following disquisition on the Roman Constitution. But I think that I have already, in many passages, made it fully evident that this particular branch of my work was one of the necessities imposed on me by the nature of my original design. And I pointed this out with special clearness in the preface which explained the scope of my history. I there stated that the feature of my work, which was at once the best in itself and the most instructive to the students of it, was that it would enable them to know and fully realize in what manner and under what kind of constitution it came about that nearly the whole world fell under the power of Rome in somewhat less than 53 years, an event certainly without precedent. This being my settled purpose, I could see no more fitting period than the present for making a pause and examining the truth of the remarks about to be made on this constitution. In private life, if you wish to satisfy yourself as to the badness or goodness of particular persons, you would not, if you wish to get a genuine test, examine their conduct at a time of uneventful repose, but an hour of brilliant success or conspicuous reverse. For the true test of a perfect man is the power of bearing with spirit and dignity violent changes of fortune. An examination of a constitution should be conducted in the same way, and therefore, being unable to find in our day a more rapid or more signal change than that which has happened to Rome, I reserved my disquisition on its constitution for this place.
Okay, Charles, thank you. Let's stop there. Thanks for reading. So let's think about how he's putting this. And there are a couple of things just in this first paragraph that are essential to our understanding, not just of the Romans, but of history itself. Notice that we judge a man in the same way we judge a republic, meaning we judge a republic in the same way we judge a man. That is very organic. The republic is not a creation of men. It is in nature itself, in the same way that we can procreate men and women, but they're a part of nature itself. We don't have the ability to create that thing. And the same thing is true with the republic. We either acknowledge what is in nature already, or we don't. If we acknowledge what is in nature, we end up with a republic. If we don't, we'll have some other form of government, or we exaggerate some aspect of nature, not in balance, but in opposition to other parts of nature. So it's in nature that we're democratic, that we're aristocratic, and that we're monarchical. But it's most natural to have all three together, not to focus on one of those branches, but to have all three. Same thing is true with a man. Every man has his intellect, his soul, and his passions. So it's the three parts of the human being that we see reflected here. But I want to point this out, and Charles read this beautifully. Anybody catch how utterly Greek and yet Roman this was at the same time? There's one sentence in here that should have just jumped out at you, especially after our discussions last Friday.
For the true test.
Yeah. This is the true test of a perfect. Remember, in the ancient world, perfect doesn't mean without flaws. It means the person who has reached what they were born to be. So whether it's a government or a person or an animal, perfection is not without flaws. It's reaching their end, their goal. They have become what they were made to be. So please don't think of it in our modern sense. And the same thing is true in Scripture. When Jesus says, be perfect as your Father is perfect, the translation is not, you are without flaw. That's not possible for us in this world. The translation should be, you should have reached what God wanted you to reach. That's what perfection is in the ancient world. It's only in the last 100 years, well, maybe 300 years actually, that we've corrupted that term to mean without flaw. But the true test of a perfect man is the power of bearing with spirit and dignity violent changes of fortune. That's how we judge. And frankly, of everything we read on Friday dealing with Stoicism, nothing we read captured Stoicism as much as that one sentence. That sentence is the essence of what Stoic philosophy is. This is how we judge somebody, by how they deal with reverses. So a man is not tested, a woman. A man and a woman, they are not tested until they are tested in the hardest thing. And we'll see this, you know, think about, as Paul writes, how are works tested? Well, they go through the purifying fire, and they're either as gold and they pass through unharmed, or they're straw and consumed. Doesn't mean you're not saved. The man whose works are of straw is still saved, but there's pain. And that's very interesting. That's a very Roman sentiment, but also a very Greek sentiment. You have to be tested by fire. And so this is how we understand it. And again, what do we find? We judge a man in the same way. So here's where we have to be very careful about this. I'm just repeating what I said about a half hour ago. But this is where we have to note that the Roman Constitution is not the creation of man. It is the discovery by men of truths over time. So it's not just sitting down and saying, let's write a constitution. It must develop. And so we don't even know. And we don't actually have great records of how the Roman Republic developed. We know there was a lot of chaos. There were a lot of civil wars. There was a lot of strife. We do know that the Senate was the very first institution of the Republic. But at some point over the next 200 years, they also created what were called the consuls. So they had a kind of executive, but they usually had dual executives. And they also created what they would have called the people, what we would call the House of Representatives. And this just kind of developed. We don't know exactly how. I mean, we could actually imagine, and I don't want to say this is the truth because we just don't know, but we could imagine that as the Senate ruled and people were opposed to it, they started seeing the Senate as elite and aristocratic, and the people may have been standing outside of the Senate chambers. And when the Senate came out, the senators came out, the people may have harassed them. And the senators may have been so disgusted by that over time, they just said, fine, make your own assembly. Do what you want. And that may have been the way we ended up with two branches. We don't know. This is all kind of lost in the mystery of time. And yet we know that by the time we get to the end of the Republic, there are, for all intents and purposes, three separate branches of government that, at least to a certain extent, mirror or anticipate what our American Republic will be like. So, Charles, would you mind reading the next two paragraphs?
Sounds good. What is really educational and beneficial to students of history is the clear view of the causes of events and the consequent power of choosing the better policy in a particular case. Now, in every practical undertaking by a state, we must regard as the most powerful agent for success or failure the form of its constitution. For from this, as from a fountainhead, all conceptions and plans of action not only proceed, but attain their consummation. I have given an account of the constitution of Lycurgus. I will now endeavor to describe that of Rome at the period of their disastrous defeat at canine.
Yeah.
As for the Roman constitution, it had three elements, each of them possessing sovereign powers, and their respective share of power in the whole state had been regulated with such a scrupulous regard to equality and equilibrium that no one could say for certain, not even a native, whether the constitution as a whole were an aristocracy or democracy or despotism. And no wonder, for if we continue our observation to the power of the consuls, we should be inclined to regard it as despotic. If on that of the Senate and as aristocratic, and if finally one looks at the power possessed by the people, it would seem a clear case of a democracy. What the exact powers of these several parts were, and still with slight modifications are, I will now state.
Great. Thanks, Charles. Well done. So here we have, and I just want to point a couple things out, and we'll go back to reading here in a moment. But if you look down at the bottom of 182 onto 183, we have a pretty good discussion, very similar to what you saw in the Melian Dialogue. Remember the Persians arguing. It's very similar, where we have a discussion about the three branches of government and what they do. And if you jump onto page 184 and then 185, he continues that. So we first get the kind of theory. Now we get the exact thing. So if you look around line 20 on 184, that whole paragraph, we get a description of executive power. At the top of 185, we have a discussion of aristocratic power through the Senate. And then we have the democracy there at the bottom of 185. And it's well worth, I don't think we need to read them out loud, but it's well worth you going through and looking at these things, because these are exactly the kind of descriptions that our founding fathers would have read in Greek and Latin and would have known as they're creating our own constitution. Now, I don't want you to think that the purpose of this class is merely to get us to the American founding. I just mean that as we're looking, it's pretty clear that our founders had a deep historical sense and understood that we could look to the experience of the Romans to figure out what this means. At the top of 186, then, we have this incredible description here of what balance of powers is. So you don't want the democracy ruling, you don't want the aristocracy ruling, and you don't want the monarchy, especially for the Romans. You don't want that ruling. You have to have balance. And we'll start getting into questions, is it better for the three branches of government to work together or be in conflict? So what does that balance of powers mean? In the American experience, we, at the very beginning, the way our founders put this, and I don't think this should be controversial, although it probably would be, and we were on CNN or Fox right now. I'm not normally on CNN or Fox. In fact, I've never been on either of them. But what we find is the founders clearly believed the three branches should not get along. They were not looking for unity. In fact, they were looking for disunity. We often talk about this as gridlock, and people will comment, gridlock is terrible. Well, if it's so, then our founding is terrible, because it's pretty clear that our founders did not want the three branches of government to agree on much of anything. But there were two cases where they had to agree. They had to agree on taxes, and they had to agree on war. Other than that, you really don't want them agreeing on things, and even then, it has to be exceptional in all kinds of ways. John?
If you put that in a kind of a partisan perspective, you could say Democrats and Republicans shouldn't work together, because if they do, they're just going to screw us over twice as much.
Here's the problem with that, John, and I understand where you're going, and I'm pretty sympathetic to it, but of course, when the founders made the the Constitution, they didn't believe in parties.
The party isn't the same as a branch.
Yeah, exactly. So the parties, remember Washington spent so much of his time railing against Americans who wanted to create parties. So, and we don't have the first official party in America until 1827, the Democratic Party. The Federalists and Anti-Federalists are movements, right? So, but yeah. No, it's a point very well taken. Yeah, so we do want that kind of opposition, but hopefully with the branches rather than with parties. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, great point. Okay, so I want to mention at least two other things with this, because we're going to get a little cynical here, not yet, but in a moment. One of the most important lines in all of this for Polybius, so you guys all have to know the true test. Right? You have to memorize that, but you need to know. And I may at some point ask you, what's Polybius's definition of Stoicism? And you know, you don't have to have it exact, but give me an example of that. So that was on the first page of this reading. But I also want you to know, because this will, even though it's earlier than Polybius, we always call this in political theory the Polybian cycles. So if anyone ever says Polybian, what they mean is this right here. And I want you to specifically look at line 27 on 186. This is, again, this is prior to Polybius, but we give Polybius credit because he's the first to put it exactly like this. So he says, line 27 there on 186, "For whereas there is in every body or polity," so whether we're talking about humans or an association or a government or a business, "a natural stage of growth, zenith, and decay." That becomes the Polybian notion or the Western notion of history. All of history, and we already saw it in the Greeks, it was there in Heraclitus, it was there at Miletus. This is almost, 400 years after Miletus. But Polybius is stating what the Greeks speculated on and what the Romans believed to be true. All of history is the history of birth, middle age, and death. Everything. There's nothing in the world that does not go through that process. Now the problem, of course, and this is where it gets super complicated, is we're never, ever, any one of us, ever at the same stage. And so it's not, we can't just say the whole government right now, the whole U.S. government is in complete decay and corruption. You could say there may be various branches, but they're going to be at various stages. So NASA may be doing really well right now. It may not be corrupt at all. Whereas the Department of Education could be utterly corrupt. And we don't know. So to say, well, and we simplify this. I hear my Texas relatives. It's like, it's all over. Republic's dead. Yeah, maybe. I mean, I'm not going to totally disagree with that. But it's been pronounced dead many, 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 many times. And, I would have thought when Socrates died, it was over. But we still remember Socrates. And that's one of the most important lessons, is that even if this does govern us, this is happening in such a complicated fashion and at so many different levels that it's hard to judge. And really, we can only judge these things in hindsight, where we go back and find it. So our founders were very concerned with this. And you don't need to know her name. You will if you take American heritage. But one of the greatest writers of the American Republic was a woman named Mercy Otis Warren, who is fantastic. She's an incredible writer. She wrote The Second History of the American Revolution in 1805. But her belief was that the founding was already over, that the Republic was done as of 1805. It was completely over. Whatever the founders had fought for, we had already lost it because we'd become decadent. It's a very standard way of thinking about history, and especially any of us who believe in a republic. We know every republic dies. That's inevitable. There's no such thing as a permanent republic. It can't be. You're not a republican, small r, if you believe the republic's permanent. But it's also very difficult to judge when it's over. So it's one of those things we just keep fighting for. Even when we're maybe losing, we keep pretending with hope that it's working. It's kind of essential. Edmund Burke once said, just because the heart seems to stop beating doesn't mean it couldn't revive at any moment. Right? It's always a possibility. And I heard this in a speech a few years ago, and I don't know how many of you are into music, but there was a great, I think, interesting movement in the 1970s, Philip Glass and some other figures which were playing with minimalism, and most people who like classical music hate minimalism. But one of the great speeches I heard by a guy named Bob Riley said, one of the greatest things about minimalism is at least you know there's still a heartbeat. Even if it's just a ridiculous heartbeat, you know there's still a possibility of revival at any point. So it's not dead, it's just kind of lingering. And that's the same that a republic may be at. It may just be kind of lingering at the moment. It may just need some kind of revival at some point. John?
Well, so, we might say that, actually since Warren wrote her book, actually, we've revived a couple times and maybe slumped again, but
exactly.
I wonder, a lot of people who said at the time that, there was no hope, they might, say, she might think that we haven't revived since,
Yeah. It could be pretty subjective, right, in the way that we analyze
it. Honestly.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, John. And it's a critical question. Now, I would argue that, let's not, I agree. It's a critical question. I was going to give another American example, but We'll go back to this. So just keep that in mind, that this becomes the way of thinking. It's just how complicated do you want to make it. But this is why, and I can't stress this enough, Christianity is revolutionary because it does argue you can break out of this cycle.
And it also, I mean, Christianity is revolutionary as a way of thinking, even if you don't buy the religion. It's radically revolutionary because it does believe we can break out of this. It also believes, as the Stoics did, that we're all equal. There's no distinction of male, female, Greek, Jew, black, white. And that was in Stoicism, but of course it's Christianity that will take that to the far corners of the world. So I always laugh when I hear people, especially feminists, mocking Christianity. You just don't know your history. I mean, there just would not be equality for women without Christianity in any way, shape, or form. Doesn't mean they always carried it out perfectly, but it's what starts it. So it's very, very strong. The other thing we have to know is that it's a different view of history because of grace. So, all right, that's not a theological statement, just a statement of philosophy about what it changes. Scott?
I was just wondering, I know there are some people, and I've talked to some of them, that think that any society is in a constant state of decay, kind of a similar concept to entropy.
Yes.
Like physical
right.
entropy.
And of course, a lot of our science
right.
comes from a lot of these ideas.
Would that be consistent with this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we're constantly in a state of decay okay. and entropy. And chaos theory, actually, chaos theory in so many ways is very, it's not meant to be, but it meshes with a lot of Republican ideals. It's not as new as the chaos theorists like to claim. It, you could say it's Epicurean in many ways, as well as Stoic. So, yeah, there's a lot of that. Dr. Kaltoff, who's a genius in our history department, he's done a lot of really good work looking at how so much of modern science is deeply rooted in Greek thought and Greek philosophy. The really interesting work on that. But especially, I think his argument, I'm no expert on this, but his argument is almost all post-Einsteinian theory is deeply Epicurean. And that the Epicureans had really, really had already predicted much of what we're going to see in post, in theories of relativity and chaos theory. So, but I'm no expert, Scott, at all. I mean, I basically just said everything I know about science. So don't push me on that. Talk to people who actually know what they're talking about. So, yeah.
Is that state of decay as soon as something is created? I mean, it can't be decaying before.
Well, for Polybius, and so this is a great question. For Polybius, it only happens for the body, it's going to happen at a certain age.
Right.
You're at the prime of your life right now. That's just, and especially as a male, you are at, and you won't really start decaying until you're about 40. Mm-hmm. And believe me, I used to laugh. My mother would say, but no, it really does happen. But it's more for a society. The decay is mirrored in the state of the soul of society. So if we believe our society is in good shape and we act that way, in a sense, it is in good shape. But once we recognize it's falling apart, it becomes very hard to stop that fall. So for a society, for a body, it's just natural. It's going to happen. I don't know when it is. I mean, for some people, I saw one of my editors, great guy. He looks like he's 25, and he told me I saw him this weekend. He's 41. And I was like, man, you know, I'm 49 and I look like I'm 59. This guy just drives me crazy. I'm not that vain. Anyway, it's just obviously the body's different. Some people age. You know, my mom still, she's 80, but she looks like she's about 65. I did not inherit those genes. But for a government, it's all based on, are the people behaving virtuously? If they behave virtuously, your society can last for a very, very long time. But the moment they start becoming interested in self and sensuality and sexuality as a part of something that's a pleasure outside of the context of social institutions, this is a theory. Mm-hmm. At that point, you're decaying. So I hope that answers you, Nate. That's a great question. So let's think about this. This is the last thing. We've only got a minute left. And my wife will pick this up. But what's the last thing, if you had a chance to read Polybius, what's he deal with? What's the last, and he's very cynical about this. What keeps the people in check? What makes sure that they remain virtuous, Nate? Marx will say it's the opium of the people.
Yeah. Religion.
Religion. It's all a game. It's not real for Polybius. It's a joke. There are no gods. There's none of that that matters. But the people believe it. And so because of that, they stay good. And that's what religion is for Polybius. Now, obviously, I'm coming from a very different perspective. But that argument is not an unjust argument. Religion tends to keep people in check until, and I don't want to sound
too bigoted about this, but once you start having a religion in which it becomes like the gospel of prosperity, that is, when religion starts being a way to get rich, it's probably not quite what Polybius is saying. Religion is meant to keep you humble, not the other way around. I don't think he would consider what we see in that prosperity gospel as a real religion, but if religion is a check on who we are, it doesn't unleash us, it keeps us, not down, that's too strong, but it keeps us humbled. It's probably the best way. Charles, you get the last word.
Okay, so he talks about like the punishments of Hades. Like,
yeah.
So would he think that the government could also punish to keep people in check?
It's more that we want those terrors.
Okay.
I want Veronica to believe in hell because it'll keep her scared. Mm-hmm. And it'll make sure that she doesn't actually hurt Laurie. Now, I would assume there are other reasons she's not hurting Lori right now, but that's kind of the way he thinks about it. Does that make sense, Charles?
Yeah.
Good. Okay. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you on Wednesday. Or, no, I won't see you on Wednesday. My wife will see you. I won't see you till Monday, so have a great week, and I hope that all the test goes really well. You guys do know, I hope, I want you to do well. It would be a bad professor who doesn't want you to do well. Thank you.